As I announced earlier this week, we are going to look at the book of Zephaniah, a book, or rather not very, very popular with many Bible teachers and pastors and many of us, because a little obscure book. And I haven't heard even that people quoting a lot from the book of Zephaniah. I don't know why. I myself haven't ever preached from the book of Zephaniah. But as I said, we are taking up the four prophets who lived during the just before Jerusalem fell to the Babylonians. These prophets are, last week we saw Habakkuk and Zephaniah, and then Ezekiel. Ezekiel is actually dated between the two deportations, 597 and 587. So Ezekiel is not exactly before the Babylonian threat, because Ezekiel came in the during the time of between the two catastrophes. But Jeremiah is actually close to that, means he just saw Jerusalem falling. So we are taking up Zephaniah now, and let's look at this. So that will be our next subject, will be Habakkuk, Zephaniah, and then we will take Jeremiah. Now, the name Zephaniah means Yahweh has guarded or saved. That's the meaning of Zephaniah. Yahweh has guarded or saved. And his parents probably must be very pious people, because they gave him, unlike other prophets. You see, say for example Habakkuk. Some other prophets also have names attached with, connected with Yahweh, but Habakkuk has nothing to do with the name of Yahweh. But his parents probably were very pious people in naming him that, or expressing their faith in naming his son as Yahweh has guarded or saved. No, but one thing is very clear, that Zephaniah is of royal descent. That is, he belonged to the royal family. Now, when we studied book of Isaiah, I had said that Isaiah probably had a royal connection. Probably he was a prince, and we saw that. But the evidence here is much more stronger, because in chapter 1 verse 1 it says, the word of the Lord that came to Zephaniah the son of Cushi. Now the whole ancestry is detailed there. Son of Gedaliah, son of Amariah, son of Hezekiah. So he is the great-great-grandson or great-great-great-grandson of King Hezekiah. Assuming that the Hezekiah mentioned here is the King Hezekiah. If that's the case, he is a royal descendant. In the book of Isaiah, we don't have a verse saying that, but we can from the premises in the book, we can conclude that Isaiah was also of royal descent. Now the date is, and that chapter, the title itself makes it very clear, that is, he prophesied during the days of Josiah, the son of Amon. Amon was a wicked king, and Josiah was considered to be a good king, a righteous king, who started ruling at the age of 8. Somebody else was ruling on behalf of him. That's true. But Josiah, during the days of Josiah, and Josiah's date or Josiah's period is rather very clearly identified as 640 to 609 BC. That is when Josiah was king over Israel. And Josiah is famous. You can't ignore Josiah especially Josiah's reform, when you study the history of Israel. And one of the things that Josiah was famous was that he reformed the worship of Yahweh in Israel, like a little bit like Hezekiah did. That may be the reason why this the prophet is connected to Hezekiah, or they have drawn his genealogy from him. Josiah was a good king. If you want to know more about Josiah, you go to 2 Kings 22 and 23 about his reforms, and you will find in 2 Chronicles 33:25 to 35:27 also the reform of the narrative about the reform of Hosea. Now his main thing is that he tried to purge Judah from idolatry. He destroyed the Asherah poles and all signs of idolatry and pagan practices from Israel. Number one. Number two, he centralized the worship, because people were worshipping in different places. You know, every hill and all that. Over the years, they have started different practices. So the main contribution of Josiah is, he said people should worship only in Jerusalem. And he even destroyed, pulled down the many worship places where people claimed that they are worshipping Yahweh. So he said Yahweh should not be worshipped in other places. He only should be worshipped in Jerusalem. So that is what we call the centralization of worship. He centered the worship only one place. And a third thing is, or that should be the first thing I mentioned, he ordered the renovation of the temple. The temple in Jerusalem was neglected because people had gone after idolatry, and people are worshipping here and there, sometimes in the name of Yahweh, sometimes in some other name. So he actually centralized the worship. But before that, in order to centralize the worship in Jerusalem, he started renovating the temple. Now he took money from, collected money from, and he asked one of the priests to be in charge of it. And that story you can find in 2 Kings 22 and 23. But while the renovation was going on, they found what is called the Book of the Law in the temple. So finding the Book of the Law in the temple is actually, that is why I should have mentioned that first. That is what gave way to the reform. He started to renovate the temple. While renovating the temple, they found an old book which they called the Book of the Law, and the revival or reform started according to what they read in that book. It was a biblical reform, and in the book they said, they found that the worship should be only in Jerusalem, and then removing the idols from their worship, pagan practices. So there was a terrific purge of the religion of Judah during the days of Josiah. Josiah, after the purge and the dedication of the temple, he celebrated Passover in the temple. That's interesting, because until then, the biblical records tells us that Passover was a family affair. It was worship. The Passover was done in the houses. That's what we know from Exodus. But he has instructed that Passover should be in the Jerusalem temple, in Jerusalem. So that is another thing he did. Maybe some more, another small thing you can say that Josiah did was to claim the unclaimed Israelite territory. By 720, Samaria was fallen, and many people were deported into Assyria, scattered in Assyria. And when Assyria was becoming weak, their control on the old Israel, northern Israel, was weak. So Josiah claimed some of those places as well, and he pretended to be the king of the united Israel, that is Israel and Judah, though Israel was already a Assyrian province. So in the order of importance, I was talking about, so probably, okay, why I'm talking about all these things? Probably the book of Zephaniah was, or the ministry of Zephaniah was, during this period. Now there are two arguments. Was it before the period, before reform started, or was it after the reform? The reason why we say it was before the reform is that Zephaniah still condemns the practices in Israel, the pagan practices in Israel. So we may conclude from that, when Zephaniah started his ministry, Israel was, the Josiah's reform had not started. If it was started, if the temple was renovated, pagan idols were removed, then Zephaniah would not have, there was no need for Zephaniah to condemn idolatry practices. But on the other side, we can also argue that though reform happened, people were still continuing the pagan practices. So there is no, you cannot put a time limit on that, whether it was before that or after that. Even after that, people had gone back to pagan worship. So let's not actually worry about that at the moment. So that much about the date. So roughly considering all this, we can actually date Hosea around 620 BC. That is, Josiah the king came to power in 640. And in his 18th year, he started the reform. So 640 minus 18 will take us to 622 approximately. So if Zephaniah started the ministry and if it was a boost for the reform, he must have started it, the ministry, around 620. But this is actually, we are not certain about it. But we would say sometime around that, circa, around 620, he ministered in Judah. How long? We have no clue. No historical details are available. But that is not also very important for our, any purpose for us now. Moving on, that is, what is in this book? This book is about, there are many things. Basically, it is about judgment. Judgment of Judah and judgment of the nations. But it is also about hope. So we'll just see that. Now, the thing is that because there's no historical narrative, there's no clarity about all that, unless we see it in the framework of the reform of Josiah, people don't find usually something very, exciting or any good morals or anything to preach from. That may be the reason why people are not actually very, this book is not very popular with preachers and even teachers. So let's move to that content of the book of Zephaniah. First of all, the opening verses, that is after the title 1-1, verses 1-2-6, he opens with a judgment against Judah. See chapter 2, verses 2-6. And that's that verse section. And but it starts with, in 2-3, starts with generally with all living beings. Let me read chapter 1, verses 2-3. I will utterly sweep away everything from the face of the earth. That's a general statement, declares the Lord. I will sweep away man and beast. I will sweep away the birds of the heavens and the fish of the sea. And The rubble with the wicked I will cut off mankind from the face of the earth, declares the Lord. Now it suggests the judgment, the announcement of judgment is against the all the people, all living beings. Then it goes on to say man and beast and fish. And in that language, the language of creation, you see, if you read Genesis 1 to 20, or you can read from 120 to 128, there we read that, you know, the way God created everything. So actually, Zephaniah is saying what God created, God will destroy the judgment. Then in verses 4 to 6, it is basic, very specifically, it narrowed down to Judah. Though he starts with a judgment against everything that God created, then it narrows down to Judah. Verse 4, I will stretch out my hand against Judah and against all the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and I'll cut off from the place remnant of Baal, that is the Canaanite god, which people began to worship, and the name of the idolatrous priests, you know, the Canaanite priests or Israelite priests, along with the priests, those who bow down on the roofs to the host of heavens. And that is basically, you know, in the ancient Canaanite culture and even Babylonian culture, they would host in the open sky, you know, they would offer sacrifices to the stars, the celestial bodies. So that is the practice here. Bow down on the roof to the host of the heavens. Host of the heavens means celestial bodies. And those who bow down and swear to the Lord, and yet swear by Milcom. Milcom is the Ammonite god. Baal is the Canaanite god. Milcom is the Ammonite god. And those who turn back from following the Lord and do not seek the Lord or inquire of him. So it's basically, this judgment against Judah is against the idolaters, who those who follow pagan practices in Judah. So here we have the judgment, though it opens with a judgment against Judah for their sins, and it is part of a general judgment that God is going to bring out. And those who are follow Baal, the Canaanite god, some people follow them, some people follow Ammonite gods, and some people follow the worship of astral deities, stars and all that. Then the second is a major section, the whole thing, but there's only one theme there, that is chapter 1 7 to 3:20, that is the rest of the book deals with one thing, and that is, but the various aspects of it in the next three chapters, that is the day of the Lord. The people in the Bible times believed that there is a day called the day of the Lord, and they did not know when, but they know that the one day Lord will take control of all the affairs, and God will bring to judgment everybody. It's a time of rewards and judgment. So that was the common belief. And we have looked at the day of the Lord when we did the book of Amos. So probably you are aware of this concept. But here Zephaniah adds a new dimension. He says there are two sides to the day of the Lord. One is judgment and the other is hope. So the day of the Lord is a judgment against those who are sinners, and it is hope for those who follow God. Now, the first part is actually 1, 7 to 3:8. Zephaniah talks about the day of the Lord, when God will judge the people, up to 3:8. From 3:9 to the end of it, he talks about the hope. The day of the Lord is also a day of hope. So we are going to deal with a larger section now. So let's move on to the first part. Now, chapter 1, 7 to 9 talks about it's basically a sarcastic statement. You know, a sacrificial statement, a sacrificial statement, he talks about punishment. Punishment will be like a festival, sacrificial festival. That is, when there is a sacrifice, or they will call a festival, and there will be, animals will be slaughtered for the. So he here says, God is going to have a sacrificial festival. And that festival will be a time when God will slaughter, not animals. God is not going to slaughter animals, but God is going to slaughter rulers and the wealthy in Judah who are sinful. God is going to punish. So let's look at verse 8 to get the real punch of it. And on the day of the Lord's sacrifices, I will punish the officials and the king's sons. So when there is a sacrifice, these are the people who come to attend the sacrifice. Sacrifice is not just slaughtering an animal. It's a huge festival. And then they eat the meat of the sacrificed animal after offering God the fat and the kidneys, the internal organs. They eat the rest of the animal. So it's a big festival. I will punish the officials and the king's sons, and also who array themselves in foreign attire, who wear foreign clothes. That means the rich, the wealthy. So here is a sarcastic statement that actually what Zephaniah says is that though there is a sacrificial festival, who will be slaughtered? It will be the people who come for celebrate the festival will be slaughtered. Specifically, rulers and wealth, those who rule and those who are wealthy. And then the next few verses, say for example, 8 verses or 9, 1, 10 to 18, it lists the punishments. God is not going to punish people for no reason. There are reasons. What are the reasons? One, first part, verses 1, 10 to 16, talks about the sins of Jerusalem. The revived God is going to punish them, slaughter them, burn them up, the wealthy and the rulers, because of the sins of Jerusalem. Now it talks about fish gate. You know, it says from the fish gate, there are some locations. Verse 10, on that day, declares the Lord, a cry will be heard from the fish gate, a wail from the second quarter, a loud crash from the hills. Now, we are not very sure where this fish gate is, where is the second quarter is and all that. And it goes on to say, the mortar, who dwell in mortar, those places are not known, identified. Probably it simply means, it is basically different quarters of Jerusalem, like we have now. In the old Jerusalem, there is a Muslim quarter, there is an Armenian quarter, there is a Jewish quarter in the little city. Similarly, in Zephaniah's time, they had identified different parts of Jerusalem, like Fish Gate to this, second quarter to this, and Mortar is another place. But whatever it is, God says, I'm going to punish you for what your sins. Then he says, not only Jerusalem, but the entire humanity will also be punished. In 1:17-18, I'll bring distress on mankind, so that they shall walk like the blind. They will be blinded, sightless, because they have sinned against the Lord. Their blood shall be poured out like dust, and their flesh like dung. It goes on like that. It's not just against Jerusalem, but it's against the ungodly humanity. God will punish them. See, when we read these oracles of judgment, we have to have a clear perspective, a proper perspective. The perspective is that we should not be imagining a wrathful God, an angry God. But the anger of God actually is a measure in proportion to the sinfulness of mankind. So when we read the prophecies, the very eerie prophecies of frightening prophecies of the book of judgment, in the oracles of judgment, we should know that, don't imagine that God is angry, but we should know that we deserve that anger. We have made God so angry, it should reflect on us, that the people who are going to be judged, that's a proper perspective. You know, we shouldn't imagine God as a very cruel God. In fact, mankind deserved even worse, but God has been kind. Now, but in the midst of all that, comes three verses. It says, though this is what is planned for the sins of the people, of Judah and the rest of the humanity, though this is planned, still there is room for forgiveness, repentance. 2:1-3. See, and particularly, okay, I'll read 1-3. Gather together, yes, gather, O shameless nation, before the decree takes effect, before the day passes away like chaff, before there comes upon you the burning anger of the Lord. You know, there is a call from God. Before there comes upon you the day of the Lord. And verse 3 says, seek the Lord. So what is the purpose of all this prophecy of judgment? It is to tell them that there is the reality of judgment planned for them, planned against them. But now the purpose of or the function of 2:1-3 is to say that this is what is going to happen to you, you sinful, wicked nation, ungodly nation. This is not just going to happen like that. But I'm still giving you some time, some room for repentance. Verse 3. Seek the Lord, all you humble of the land, who do his just commands. Seek righteousness and seek humility. Perhaps you may be hidden on the day of the anger of the Lord. There is a promise. The offer. The offer is that those who seek the Lord, those who do righteousness, will find his mercy, will receive his mercy, and they will be hidden. The idea is they will be hidden so that the destruction will not happen. See, like this has happened, you know, in history, when the 10th plague in Egypt, when the firstborn was killed, the people who had there on the doorpost the sign of the lamb, the blood, they were spared. The angel of death did not touch them. So they were hidden. Similarly, describing before and after this verse, the severe punishment for the people of Judah and the whole humanity, God offers them, here is a place. If you return to God, if you turn to be godly, I am, will prepare you a place where you can hide. That means you can escape the judgment, while others who don't return, do not seek God, will be annihilated. Now, the judgment continues again. But this time, in chapter 2, verse 4, 2, 3, 8, it is against the nations. And it's not, we are not unfamiliar with this trend in the book of, in the books of prophets. The prophets also had a message against the nations, that God is going to deal with the wicked nations. Now, Zephaniah actually follows a style similar to Amos. Now, when we studied Amos, Amos chapter 1 to 3, 1 to 2, 3, verse 3, there is the oracle against nations. It starts with countries far away and then comes close to the people near Israel, Judah, then Israel. So it is, you know, it's a very enjoyable thing to hear that God is against their enemies. And but finally, Amos said, you, Israel, are also sinful. God is against you. And the rest of the prophecy is like that. So similarly, Zephaniah also talks about the same thing. He talks about Israel's neighbors, Judah. Now there is no Israel. It's almost 100 years since Israel ceased to be a nation. After the it fell in 720, and Zephaniah is prophesying in 620. If you take that, it's almost a century after Israel is fallen. Now, then he directly addresses Judah. Now, let me just go through some of the countries, the list of the countries given there. He starts with the country of Philistines, the land of Philistines, in 2:4-7. He starts with the Philistines who lived in the southwest of Judah, the coastal plains in the southwest, covering what is called as Shephelah, a very fertile land. And the Philistines built their Pentapolis, that is, they lived as a confederation of five cities. It was a federation of five cities. And the five cities are Gath, Gaza, Ashkelon, Ashdod, and Ekron. These five cities were Philistines, and they made a confederation, and they lived as one nation, or you can say like a federation like India is. But now, interestingly, in this list, I hope you have read this book before coming to a class, there is no reference to Gath. Only four cities are mentioned. Four cities in the sense, four cities, city-states are mentioned. Gath is left out. Why? Probably, by this time, Gath is also destroyed by the Assyrians. And most likely, in the first half of the 8th century, when King Ahaz requested Assyrian help, and Assyrians must have destroyed or attacked Gath. He attacked Philistines, the Assyrians might have destroyed completely Gath. That is why by the time of Zephaniah, there was no Gath to talk about. That may be the reason. But the sum and substance of this is that God is against Gath. Now, in chapter 2, 8-11, Zephaniah picks up two other nations, which is on the other side of Jordan, on the western side. The Philistines are on the coast, southwest coast. Then Zephaniah mentions two nations, Moab and Ammon, which is on the other side of Jordan, that is the western bank of Jordan. Western side of Jordan. Western bank may mean something else. And their sin is making fun of the people of Israel. Verse 8, I have heard the taunts of Moab and the revilings of Ammonites, how they have taunted my people and made boasts against their territory. That is a serious crime too, making fun of the people of God. So God is going to judge Moab and Ammon for ridiculing his people. Now, the next nation he picks up is Cush. 2:12. Cush is what we now know as Ethiopia and Egypt combined. Cush is a term that Bible uses most of the time. It refers to the Ethiopians and the Egyptians put together. Sometimes Cush was, the rulers of Cush had dominated Egypt. Some pharaohs were even from Cush. So Kush is a general term. It is not just a territory. Actually, sometimes it was a territory, sometimes it was not a territory. But actually, like we, when we say Indian subcontinent, you know, it is not only India that is involved in it. That's many things. So similarly, Kush was, so God is said, I am against Kush too. Then the next prophecy talks about the destruction of Assyria. Now, in during the period of Zephaniah, Assyria was a power still until 612. That is, when Zephaniah was prophesying, Assyria was there, but Assyria was weak. But Babylon was getting stronger. And in 612, Assyrians, the Nineveh, capital of Nineveh was destroyed. Assyrians were defeated and the Babylonians became the superpower. So, this prophecy in 2:13, and he will stretch out his hand against the north and destroy Assyria, and he will make Nineveh, Nineveh is the capital of Assyrian Empire, a dry waste like the desert. So this was fulfilled in 612 or 612 BC. The fall of Nineveh, the fall of the end of the Assyrian Empire. Now this much is fine, because God is against the nations, the enemies of Israel. But in the next verses, Zephaniah uses the same strategy that he used, that Amos used, to say that, now, it's right, God is going to destroy these powerful nations, but his righteousness, his just God, is not going to stop with that. He is also going to deal with the sinful people, ungodly people in Jerusalem, the capital of Jerusalem, and in the whole state of Judah. That is the remaining part of the prophecy. That is 3:1-7. So he says, the same God who will judge the nations will judge you too. And that is the, generally all prophets talk about, in speak in that way. Then he talks about especially two things. One is, in verse 3, he talks about the wickedness of its rulers. The wickedness of its rulers. Verse 3. Her officials within her are roaring lions. He's talking about the royal officials. Her judges are evening wolves looking for some prey that leave nothing till the morning. So Zephaniah says, look, your rulers, your bureaucracy are like something, nocturnal animals looking for prey and destroy everything, eat up everything, kill everything by before dawn. So that is the judgment against these people. That is the sin. You know, this is a sentiment, is what we see in the book of Amos and the book of Isaiah and all that. The wicked rulers. God says, I am going to deal with these wicked rulers. Then a second group that God is going to deal with is the fickle-minded spiritual leaders, prophets and priests. They haven't respected the word. So God says, I will deal with them also. I will destroy them also. I will punish them also. Verse 4, chapter 3, verse 4. Her prophets are fickle, treacherous men. Her priests profane what is holy. You know, when we come to Jeremiah, we'll see that Jeremiah's main struggle was with the false prophets. When he preached what is true, there were, for one Jeremiah, true prophet, there were hundreds of false prophets. Jeremiah had to struggle with them. And Amos also, in a certain extent, has to struggle with an unrighteous priest in the sanctuary of Bethel. So, He says the priests and the prophets are corrupt. You know, priests consider things which are holy as profane. You know that this truth from the story of Eli and his sons, Hophni and Phinehas. They treated the sacrifices as profane. They were not holy themselves. Now, this is a similar situation. So he says, the wickedness of your leaders, and we already saw that God is, in the previous chapter, we saw first chapter, that God is going to slaughter in his sacrifice festival the rich and the well-dressed and the rulers, the kings and their sons. Because wealth and wickedness go together in the ancient societies particularly. Without exploitation, you cannot become a rich person. Now, this is the danger. But what is more important is, having given us a picture of the wickedness of the rulers and the fickle-mindedness of the spiritual leaders, it focuses on the faithfulness of God. That's the beauty of the prophecy of Zephaniah. And verse 5 says, in the midst of wicked leaders and fickle-minded prophets, here is God who shines through. Verse 5, the Lord within her is righteous. He does no injustice, though the wicked leaders will like ravenous lions, like wolves. He does no justice, injustice. Every morning he shows forth his justice. Each dawn he does not fail. But the unjust knows no shame. See, that is the glory of God that Zephaniah sees. Then this righteous, holy God says, this gives a call. I said, in verse 7, I said, surely you will fear me. You will accept correction. Then your dwelling place would not be cut off according to all that I have appointed against you, which is chapter 1 and 2 and up to 3, 6. 3, he says, I am not going to do that. But all the more they were eager to make all their deeds corrupt. But he says, if you accept my correction, here is an offer from God, the righteous God. The leaders are corrupt, the leaders are fickle-minded, the spiritual leaders are unholy and ungodly. Here is the glory of God, here is the righteous God, just God, who says, come, I will not do what I have prophesied against you. I will have show compassion. That's the judgment, but it also ends in hope. But the remaining part, the last part of the book of Zephaniah, is all about hope. The day of the Lord, this is all part of the day of the Lord. The day of the Lord is not just judgment. The day of the Lord also has a side to it. And that side is the hope that God gives. That is found in chapter 3, verses 9 to 20. He says, yeah, the first thing is that there's a possibility, it's not a possibility, it's ordained by God that the nations will turn to God. You remember the prophecy of Isaiah, chapter 2, that the nations will seek Yahweh in Jerusalem. And Micah chapter 4, 1 to 4, which talks about people coming and seeking, the nations coming and seeking God. The same thing, the same ethos we can see in Zephaniah also, where he says the nations will bring sacrifices. They'll come to worship. And chapter 3, for at that time I will change the speech of the peoples to a pure speech. Remember Isaiah saying, that I am a man of unclean lips. I live among people of unclean lips. So people don't say, they don't have pure speech. But God says, I am going to turn that impure speech to pure holy speech, their language. And then God says, Judah will also return to God in the next few verses. 11 to 13. Judah will also return to God. Then in 3:14 to 17, God gives the people, those who turn to him, a song to sing. That is 3:14 to 17, a song to sing. And let's just narrow down to one verse there, 3:15. The Lord has taken away the judgments against you. He has cleared away your enemies. Now that is, now we know why there is a long section of the prophecy against the nations. Because God has dealt with them. Your enemies are taken care of. The King of Israel, the Lord, you see that language? Who is the King of Israel? The King of Israel is not the monarch who reigns in capital. That is not even Josiah. And same thing, same sentiment that Isaiah had. Isaiah called Yahweh the king while Uzziah was sitting on the throne. The King of Israel, the Lord, is in your midst. You shall never again fear evil. That song they sing is actually about the steadfastness, unchanging Yahweh. They have to recognize that the ruler is not the king who have descended from David, who is ascended the throne because of his genealogical connections. But the real ruler, as Isaiah said, my eyes have seen the king, the Lord of hosts. Same thing Zephaniah repeats 200 years after Isaiah, that the King of Israel, note the word Israel, that means the king of all the 12 tribes or the is Yahweh. God is the king. And then the prophecy ends with a promise of restoration in 3:18 to 20. 3:18 to 20 is a promise of restoration. Though we cannot read all that verses, just one verse, that is 19. Behold, at that time I will deal with all your oppressors, and I'll save the lame and gather the outcasts, and I will change their shame into praise and renown in all the earth. That is how Zephaniah ends his message, with the promise of restoring them, giving beauty for the ashes. So he says there is glorious hope for God's people. So why the whole prophecy talks about judgment? God says judgment. A just God judges sinners. But the same just God restores the righteous, the godly. That is the plan of God. That's the economy within which God works. That is, because he is just, he cannot tolerate sin and wickedness. But since he is saying for the same reason, that he is a just God, he will keep the righteous, the godly, protect them and restore them. A small book of 3 chapters has such a very, very powerful message. I hope you really had a new insight into the book of Zephaniah. Now you can read it on your own, and each passage, each part of it will speak to you with this short framework that I have tried to give within this about an hour or less than an hour. God bless you.